C'era te, se vuoi dire.
If that's doable, that's okay.
I am build break now. I am build break.
I think everybody's getting tired. I didn't have to make any threats to get it quiet here this time. So I can relate to that. Could we start the recording, please? And I'm sorry I didn't say stop it at the last meeting. I keep forgetting that. Okay. You figured me out that I would forget that, right? So did you say it has started already? Okay. Thank you very much. So welcome to our next session. And the first part of this session will be the RADW report. That's a joint working group with the SSAC and the GNSO, and I think other participants as well. So, Jeremy, welcome, and I'll let you take over.
Thanks so much. My name is Jeremy Hitchcock, co-chair along with Edmund Chung on the IRD working group, and just as a bit of background, this working group was convened December of 2009 to look at internationalized content in the WHOIS and what potential approaches might be interesting for going forward in terms of having data represented in an internationalized format. This has come up a couple times in terms of internationalized registrants and also in some SSAC reports that have recommended looking at the particular issue in terms of data in the WHOIS not being presented in an internationalized standard format. So right now we are we've been having biweekly meetings to look at the scope of the problem. Currently looking at what type of data WHOIS reports back. What's the behavior of different ccTLDs as they've looked at how they've handled internationalized content, and we're going to give you an update of what our current work is, where we are, basically an inventory of what exists out in the wild and what are some of the use cases, problem cases that we've come up with. And our goal is to put together a report for the GNSO in November of 2010. So the generic problem is internationalized data doesn't really exist for the actual WHOIS content. So domain names and any sort of labels in DNS have a standard IDNs, and that works out pretty well. And so you combined that with the lack of any sort of guidance in terms of WHOIS content, and this is specifically looking at the requirement in RAA about, I don't remember the specific language, but it's basically a web-based and a port 43 WHOIS service. And so we're looking at these two aspects in terms of what type of data should be represented. So as I alluded to a little bit, this has been something that's come up in SSAC a little bit. In terms of some concerns of what type of data, in terms of date formats, contact information, representations of the actual the sponsoring registrar. And this group was convened with somebody from the GNSO and myself representing SSAC, and we have a pretty international representation from different ccTLDs, different countries. And some people that have been touching and been around this issue for a little bit. So I think we have a pretty good representation in terms of the what the problem space actually looks like. So we're currently looking at what the general service requirement is and trying to understand the WHOIS requirement in the sense of when it was instituted as a ASCII, US ASCII standard. One of the things I think that's somewhat unique is that ccTLDs typically look for and only have a think about registrants inside a country. So there's not a cross script an issue that comes up where you might be in a Cyrillic script country and you might be looking at kanji character in terms of a registrant. So that's something that from a localized user experience that has come up is kind of an interesting problem. And the last part as far as what's the actual submission and display alternatives, what sort of guidance could and recommendations could we come up with in terms of the actual who is requirement or who is representation. And so that's basically the problem that we've been looking at. So the kind of the generic problem, at least from using common vocabulary that they might be familiar with, is the U label and A label. And so the U label is a Unicode form of an IDN label. So that would be the first set that's highlighted in that box. And then the second is kind of an ASCII-ized representation, a Punicode representation. And so the WHOIS protocol is kind of a very simple protocol, and it's basically a plain text, no sort of character representation. And so anytime we've talked about IDNs and the actual representation of the Punicode format, there's been a lot of care that goes into thinking about what types of characters are allowed and what types of scripts. And this is logic that exists now in IDNs. WHOIS port 43 doesn't have this type of intelligence, and so one of the requirements that we've been discussing is whether WHOIS client should actually be required to query a domain either in a U label format or an A label format, basically being the question part. So is the question part only in the Punicode, or is it also in the actual Unicode representation? And then on the second part, what's the return? What's the actual data set that's given back? Is the data set given back only in an ASCII format? Is it transliterated? And so the question is, how can you ask in WHOIS on port 43, and how do you get the answer back? So that's kind of the summation or the non-technical format of what we're looking at in this. So WHOIS protocol has no mechanism for providing any sort of preferred character set to use either with the input or the output. There's been a couple of different protocols that have come up that for registry data. I don't know if the group has been trying to kind of straddle what's the actual requirement versus what other systems have existed in the past. So we haven't, certainly familiar with the IRIS system and some other things, but we've been trying to stay away from the actual technical specification or protocol specification. We're mostly looking at what do we require from WHOIS in order to gracefully handle internationalized characters. So the local, I talked about a little bit, but the localized user experience in terms of users who want to submit and have data represented in familiar sets, we've talked about a few cases where individuals are trying to either, and we're without being too specific, but basically one person in one script language trying to contact somebody in a completely different script family. And how does the postal system handle that type of event now? Can you mail if you're in mainland China using a particular character script? Can you mail a piece of postal mail to somebody in Russia using Cyrillic characters? And the world has handled that in somewhat of a graceful fashion, but that type of experience does not currently exist in the internationalized domain world yet. So the actual WHOIS requirements in terms of are listed in the RAA in a section, and there isn't, aside from saying what the domain name is, the name servers, there isn't much that's been given in terms of the specificity of what and how those things are represented by. The port 43 WHOIS service is a protocol that ITF has published and I think amended a couple times, and so that gives some sort of institutionalization of what actually has been current best practices. But in terms of different formats, especially for telephone numbers or dates, you know, those have different types of representations depending upon what country you're in. So an approach for domain names, who is services should return an A label and a U label representation, as well as the variants for IDN domains queried. So that's one thing that this group, I think, has come to in terms of a requirement or an approach for the actual domain name. Name servers, kind of a similar fashion. It's the same type of data that's being given back, so they should be displayed in both A label and U label format to the extent that that's available. For the sponsoring registrar, to always make available an ASCII to aid the identification of the registrar, and to the extent consistent with the registrar accreditation, also make it available in local scripts. Again, this might be for registrars who target particular geographies or to particular customer sets with based on their local languages. We've looked at the U123 standard, which is an ITU standard for phone numbers, and that seems to be a pretty widely accepted standard. For dates, this type of data in terms of creation dates, expiration dates, this is passed back and forth between registrars and registries, and there's a time format that's referenced in the EPP standards in terms of a date and a time, and that's something that the working group has generally looked to. Registration status, whether or not there's different codes that are passed back. This has been something that the working group hasn't really talked about terribly much, but it's been either the hold or other type of there you go. It could either leave in the current ASCII 7, which is what it is now, the exact EPP status code, more easily understood representation, some of the messages that registrants expect, which is like a registrar lock is actually a combination of two EPP codes or two actual statuses that a domain is in, or publish the easily understandable representation in the local character script, whatever that would be. So the three approaches, modeling for display, entity names, and there's basically been three different models that we've been looking at in terms of registrant name, administrative contact, technical contact, and postal addresses. So these are kind of the ones in which there's different, you can play with different flavors of how you represent internationalized content. And so the first one is that registrants submit name must be present language. So registrars are responsible for providing the ASCII version of the data. So even though somebody, registrant, is using all Cyrillic characters, in this particular example, they also have to provide kind of the ASCII-ized version of what that actual content means. Computerized fashions for doing this exist. The working group doesn't have the greatest breadth to say whether or not it can be completely automated or not, but it seems like that there's some human intervention that has to be applied to this type of approach. Second approach is that the local scripts are provided by the registrant, and registrars provide a point of contact. And so in this particular flavor, local contact information or contact information is provided only in the local language or local script, and registrars are to provide a contact and responsible for translation issues. And so in the purposes of getting a hold of somebody, it would be up to the registrar as the point of contact for a particular domain holder. And so that would alleviate the cross-country boundaries and translation boundaries that have cropped up in some of the examples that we're looking at. And then the third one is a transliteration service. And so this is a automated version of an ASCII-ized version. And again, this is something that may or may not be workable. This is something that the working group is still exploring a little bit in terms of how feasible is this to provide some sort of transliteration on behalf of registrants. And we've been looking at this approach more in an automated fashion. One issue that has come up is what is the recommendation for the current port 43 who is, and just going through the different things that have come up regarding this. I think the working group would desire that there's backward compatibility and there's an enhancement that's made, but the alternative, of course, is that there's an additional service that's on an additional port. But we've been mostly looking at backwards compatibility for port 43. So the first potential approach in terms of backward compatibility is that there's a completely compatible with both 43 requests and response in ASCII only. And another one is enhanced port 43 request, allowing domain name in ULABEL form or ALABEL form. Another one is enhanced port 43 request, allowing domain names in ULABEL form or ALABEL form, plus the requested script code. This has been something I think that some ccTLDs have done, kind of a combination of this third and the fourth option, which is enhanced port 43 response allowing ASCII and UTF-8. We've seen some ccTLDs providing WHOIS service with some additional flags that can be specified to request registrant data in different formats, either a UTF-8 format or a particular local script or ASCII. Another one is shifting to another port, replacing port 43, or having something alongside port 43, or shift to a web-based port 80, HTML5, and something along those lines. Web browsers have a little bit greater indication of what the accepted languages are for a particular web browser, and so the requirement for providing registrant data, the technology framework around HTTP is a little bit more robust than WHOIS for handling different language scripts. So this is something that we're currently soliciting feedback for, and this is kind of where we are in the working group. So our next steps is to look at the different alternatives. We've been kind of going through and developing pros and cons for each one of the approaches after since we finished the inventory of different issues. Of course, after that is to consider what the impacts, benefits are to users and stakeholders, thinking about people who consume WHOIS, people who provide WHOIS services, what type of changes that they would have to make, and registrants in terms of what is necessary of them in terms of whether they would have to be required to provide ASCII 7-bit ASCII for representation of their data in an ASCII format, and hopefully come up with a single recommendation and produce a report again in targeting at the November timeframe. So I think at this point, be happy to answer any questions.
Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering if the working group has looked at or was considering looking at what registrars do now in regards to, you know, multilingual customers who may not be able to enter anything in ASCII, but I'm sure they're registering domain names and how that's being dealt with, some kind of conversion or exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, we've been looking at what the current practice is, what current registrars who specialize mostly in the gTLD space. We've also been looking at ccTLDs in terms of what things that they've done that haven't necessarily been as part of kind of a, not a best practice, but not recommended before, kind of their own unique approach. And there's been probably a half a dozen ccTLDs that do different interesting things. But you know, certainly are looking at what registrars are doing in terms of registrars who support IDN and what type of data and how they pass that data back. And if, you know, certainly I'd love to, you know, maybe we could catch up a little bit to find out if there's anything specific you want have in mind in terms of making sure that we're paying attention to in terms of impacts.
Oh, I'll just go ahead since Chuck is preoccupied over there.
Yeah.
Mike Rodenbaugh. What's your time frame in this group, and how participatory is the group? How many folks have been active and that sort of thing? It's one of the few groups I'm not involved in, so curious.
Well, there's always yeah, we can always include you.
No.
I think the representation is 14 people. We probably have an average attendance of around 7 or 8. We've been doing kind of a one meeting in one time zone, another meeting in a different time zone, and trying to share what the kind of the conversation has been in terms of the different groups in order to cross pollinate between kind of the two sessions.
And the time frame?
And the time frame is November that we're looking for, coming up with a complete report.
And one more question. So this is, I guess it seems obvious, this is designed to, we would need to initiate a PDP around that time, and this is not for the new TLDs, but this is for existing TLDs as well.
This is a charter that was... that was put together. That was to task a working group to come up with some answers. So, what happens with these recommendations, I think, is kind of outside of my expertise.
This is Julie Headland. This group is, as you might imagine, a group that's focused more on the technical aspects of this issue, and the report will have some recommendations, and that will go to the GNSO Council and the other supporting SOs and ACs, and there'll need to be a determination based on that report what the policy aspects might be, and that would be a decision made in the GNSO how to what would be the next steps after this report. So this report and this group in and of itself is not making policy recommendations. That would be something that would follow on from this, conceivably.
By the way, Mike, thanks for asking a question I was going to ask. I appreciate you picking up the ball there. And Julie, thank you for clarifying that on the policy development. This is not a policy development working group, but rather a review of the technical standards and to take a look at, okay, what kind of technical requirements might be necessary and would work and so forth. And so it's critical in terms of being able to move forward with any policy development that might follow that. Mm-hmm. Any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you very much, and thank you both of you for Edmund's still down there. For co-chairing this, and most of you have heard me say that this is an area that we've needed to work on for a long time. We've had second-level IDNs for many years, and the WHOIS protocol that we live with now is very limited and archaic. So ultimately, it will need to lead to some policy development work so that as we continue to expand IDN registrations, both at the second and top level, the directory services that go with that can accommodate it. Thank you very much. And now we go to the next working group review, which is the RAA, correct? Hey, Steve, it's all yours.
Thank you. I'm Steve Metallitz. I'm the co-chair of this drafting team on improvements to the RAA. And I wasn't quite sure why these two reports came together at the same meeting, but besides the fact that I'm on both of these groups. But I think it's also because neither of them is actually a policy development process, and although there might be some policy implications. We're just going to run quickly through some slides that are prepared for the session we're going to do on Monday at 5:30, 17:30, as a kind of a plenary session, and there you see the brief outline of that. But just to get into the what the report is, the other parts of the plenary are have to do with law enforcement perspectives and registrar perspectives and others. So I hope I would certainly encourage everybody to attend that at 17:30 in whatever the big room is on tomorrow. This gives you a little bit of the background. The event preceding what's on here was the Register Fly debacle, which led to a call by the CEO of ICANN for a comprehensive review of the RAA. That went on for a couple of years. And then in March, I'm leaving out a lot of steps, but in March 2009, the GNSO Council approved a resolution for a new form of the RAA, but also as part of that, as a condition of that, that there be further work done on the RAA, and particularly in the two areas in the italic bullets there, that a draft response, registrant rights and responsibilities charter be prepared, and that a group identify additional amendment topics and make suggestions for next steps for further amendments to the RAA. There was a resolution adopted to set up the charter of this group, and then we've really been working since about last September on these two topics. We have two separate sub-teams. I'm the chairman of sub-team B, which is identifying additional amendment topics. The registrant rights charter chair is Bo Brendler, who unfortunately is not here. So, but we have included information about that part of the report, and hopefully you won't be asking very many questions about it because I'm not sure I could answer them, but I'll do my best. This, and we'll start with A. This is the charter information. There is a provision in the RAA that says if there's a registrant rights statement, that all registrars will link to that, to a web page. And what this the material that's in the report is basically restating what's currently in the most recent version of the RAA, the 2009 version. It's based on a non-lawyer's guide to the RAA that was developed by the staff. So you'll see in the report the full text of this. And the next steps, as stated here, the staff is consulting with the registrars and will implement a web page, which then ultimately the registrars would be required to link to. I should have said that the entire initial report is now out for public comment, too. So I'm just stating what's in the report. Obviously, public comment might come in, would come in and could change this. And I think the public comments are due July 9th, if I'm not mistaken. So. Then there was. I should also say that another thing that unites this group with the one that was just presented was that this is really like that one, which is a GNSO SAC project. This is a GNSO ALAC project, the At-Large Advisory Committee, which participated in both sub teams, and I know in my sub team made a very very significant contribution, and I'm sure the same was true in the other sub team. And their view is that there should, beyond stating what the current RAA provides as far as the rights and responsibilities of registrants, there should be an aspirational charter describing the rights that it thinks should be afforded to the registrants. And that was also included it was included in the report. This was not, you know, adopted by the sub-team. This was the kind of a working list of some of the things that should be an aspirational list. And obviously this has some feedback with what amendments might occur to the RAA. So they're all listed here. And, again, this was discussed in sub-team A and is part of the report but is not operational at this point. Okay, the next slide. Turning to sub-team B, we did reach out for suggestions of topics. There was a public notice of this, and we got suggestions mostly from four areas. First, we got a very detailed and I thought very useful submission from the ICANN staff reflecting not only the views of the compliance staff, which works every day with the RAA, and not only the views of the registrar liaison, but really the whole staff. A lot of parts of the staff worked on this, and as I said, I think it was very useful. We had some extensive suggestions from a group of law enforcement agencies from five or six countries, and they presented their material also. I think they had some presentations on it at the Seoul meeting of ICANN, and you may have seen that. There weren't law enforcement members on our sub-team, but we did have one meeting that was devoted to walking through all of their suggestions with a law enforcement representative. That was very useful. There were a number of suggestions from a working group of the intellectual property constituency, and then Danny Younger, who is an individual member of the at-large, also gave us some very detailed suggestions. And I think and when you see the list of priority topics, all of these, some of them are drawn. There's a lot of overlap among these four groups, and I think all of them are well represented in what we came out with. Okay, for the next slide, I just wanted to make it clear that the list doesn't cover a few things. For example, a lot of the suggestions from law enforcement and some other suggestions really didn't have to do with the terms of the RAA. They had to do with the due diligence that would be needed in the accreditation process. So before you became an accredited registrar, you know, the background checks and this type of thing that would have to be done. We figured that was, I think everyone agreed that was important. We figured that was outside of our remit, which was just to look at the RAA. This was at the earlier stage of who is asked to sign the RAA. And I believe the staff is going to be coming out with a revised application form that's going to reflect some of these due diligence issues. So hopefully soon. You won't see anything. I think we basically cleared those things off our list. We went through each suggestion, and in many cases there was discussion about whether was this really an amendment that was needed to the RAA, or was possible to the RAA, or was it a question of better enforcement of the existing RAA? And so we kind of asked our expert on this, which was Dave Giza, head of the contract compliance staff, to give his shop's opinion on this. And in general, we're, I think, in pretty much all cases, where he said, we think this is basically a compliance matter. We, again, took that off our list, at least provisionally. There was a feeling, and it's reflected in the report, that we should keep an eye on these issues, and if it turns out that the 2009 RAA really doesn't provide tools for dealing with them, then perhaps they could be subject of future amendments. And again, this is an area where we work with the compliance staff. And finally, we were asked to flag any issues that we thought were better suited to consensus policy development or that were involved in current PDPs. And what we did is we didn't flag too many of these issues, but when we did, we just took them off our priority list. There were some things that were suggested, for example, that are being dealt with right now by the PENDR working group and so forth. So you won't see these on the list. Obviously, there might be other items on this list that the council or that ICANN council might decide should go through, you know. There's some that could go through the PDP process if that were desired, but we took out the ones that were flagged as clearly in that bailiwick. Okay, so that brings us to the the list of topics. And what we did was we ended up it was a somewhat involved process, which is described in the report, but we ended up with a list of 12 high priority topics. These are not in themselves in priority order. Just to go through them very briefly, the suggestion was the RAA should include a prohibition on cyber squatting by registrars, with the footnote, if you will, that there should be a contractual definition of cyber squatting, and that this should be grounds for termination of accreditation if this cyber squatting activity is shown. Second point is that registrar should have a duty to investigate and report to ICANN on actions taken in response to reports received from credible third parties demonstrating illegal malicious conduct involving a domain name. That's not part of the RAA now. Third was a requirement for registrars to designate a technically competent point of contact on malicious conduct issues that would be available 24/7. This is something law enforcement and others really felt strongly about. And it's possible that that requirement could be extended to resellers and to the proxy or privacy services, which we'll talk about in a minute. Fourth point was to require the registrars to disclose the privacy or proxy services that they make that are made available in connection with registrations that they sponsor, so that it's clear and ICANN knows who those are, and to make it clear that the registrars are responsible for compliance by those services. So, for example, a license could be canceled because a license by a proxy service could be canceled in order to keep the proxy service from taking on the responsibility for misconduct by the licensee, that could be made the registrar could be made responsible for compliance. Number five would spell out in more detail than is now in the RAA what would be required of privacy and proxy services in terms of the relay function and the reveal function about the contact data on registrants who use the privacy or proxy services when the proxy service is presented with reasonable evidence of actionable harm. That's the current standard. But to clarify that, and to spell out in more detail what's expected of these services. The sixth point deals with, obviously, a lot of proxy and privacy services are not really offered in connection with registration by that registrar. They're just independent services, someone who registers a domain name and then licenses it to somebody who licenses it to a third party. And so this suggestion, and I should say that in each case we have in the report the cross-reference to the matrix and to the particular suggestions that came in from one of the four groups, this suggestion deals with those circumstances where the registrar is not responsible for the failure of the proxy service to live up to its obligations under the agreement, but that it does have a responsibility to cancel that registration where the proxy service is not living up to it. On to the next slide. The seventh priority topic was to define the circumstances under which the registrar is required to cancel a registration for knowingly false WHOIS data. Currently, the registrar may cancel it, but is not required to, so this would spell that out. The eighth point would be to consider requiring compliance with PCI or some other pre-existing standard in taking registrations, so as to assist in the verification of registrants. There are a number of suggestions about verification, but this seemed to be the most feasible one because it relies on a pre-existing standard that many registrars would use if they're accepting credit cards for registrations. The ninth point is to define the reseller. It's interesting that the new RAA does impose on the registrars some obligations to be responsible for the activities of their resellers, but it doesn't actually define what a reseller is. And several of the registrar representatives on the group raised this point, and so we actually added this point in order to clarify what registrars were and weren't responsible for. The tenth priority item is to require greater disclosure of registrar affiliates and multiple accreditations. It also could apply to major resellers if that category could be defined, but again, to make it clearer And particularly for ICANN and its compliance functions, when a registrar is affiliated with other registrars or holds multiple accreditations. The 11th point, which again was highly reflected in a lot of the law enforcement proposals and others, was to require greater disclosure of registrar contact information, information about their form of business organization and their officers. Today, and this is to strengthen what's already in the agreement so that ICANN actually knows who it's doing business with. And the final high-priority item was to clarify registrar responsibilities in connection with UDRP proceedings. Basically, the main focus here is setting timelines for registrar response, both at the beginning of the process when they have to when an action is initiated, and then at the end of the process after a successful UDRP action for the registrar to take the steps necessary for transfer or cancellation of the domain. And these have both been problem areas, and in part because the RAA is not specific on the timelines that are involved. So those were the main issues that we identified, culled from actually a list of over 100 suggestions that we received. And our first run-through, we ended up with such a large number of high-priority items, it was obviously not, it wasn't feasible. So we took, we went through, made a second cut through and ended up with this list. And then if you look at the next slide, I think, you'll see the ones that didn't make the cut, and so we call those medium priority items. And rather than walk through all of those, they're just listed here. Again, this is indicative of the scope of suggestions that we received and that were the subject of discussion within the group. On the next slide, you see, I think, the suggestions or how we dealt with our other assignment, which was to suggest the process that should be used for next steps, and really the process for developing new RAA amendments. I think there was a lot of agreement within the group that there should be, when these are negotiated, there needs to be more reporting out about text, proposed text, and where the negotiations stand, but there were definitely disagreements about who should be in the room. Strong support position, again, using the standard labels that we've been using in working groups, I guess, were to include observers representing the interests of affected non-parties in the negotiations, not as full participants, but as observers. There was substantial opposition to that from the registrars on the group who did not want to have the observers in the room, but they did stress their commitment to providing regular reports out. And then some sub-team members